the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Well, no matter how much you may be tempted if you're a male by the latest Tom Cruise movie, be it Mission Impossible 7 or indeed Top Gun, to actually wear those Ray-Bans and sunglasses, maybe it's not the best choice if you're actually putting that up on a dating profile, especially if you want to actually make eye contact with individuals. Why is this the case? Well, we're going to find out over the next few moments by speaking to dating and relationship coach extraordinaire, that's Persia Lawson. How are you, Persia?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. So this notion, I mean, I can understand why people say, yes, the shades, they're always good from that point of view. But it does seem as though a substantial number of singles, specifically 68%, according to this research, are actually put off by people wearing the sunglasses.
Yes, indeed. And it makes sense, really, doesn't it? I mean, the research that the dating app Badoo has done, I found really interesting. So like you said, 68% of people are saying that they're put off by it. And 46% of people say that it makes it too tricky to see what someone looks like. So while on the one hand, wearing sunglasses might make you seem cool and might make you appear that, you know, you're on holiday, you live a really, you know, cosmopolitan, interesting lifestyle. At the end of the day, the eyes are the window to the soul. And when it comes to dating, what you're looking for is to have a connection with someone. And I know that I've seen someone who might look great in sunglasses. When they take them off, it's like they look completely different. So I think that there's a sense that sunglasses are, people often can use sunglasses to kind of hide how they look or to hide and mask insecurities.
So it's not the classic case of the Hollywood star who's secretly wearing shades just to actually maintain that anonymity, presumably.
Well, I think maybe it is a sense of maintaining anonymity. I don't think people are necessarily conscious that they're doing this, but I know, like, I like wearing sunglasses often, even when it's not particularly sunny outside. And when I've thought about what is this about, it's like, you know, I used to be an actor, and one of the things that they say that actors often do on stage is they'll go and like stand behind furniture because it's a way of kind of concealing yourself. And I think that that's what's really going on here, that people are subconsciously trying to kind of just protect themselves because it feels very exposing and sometimes confronting to put yourself out there on a dating app.
In a world where clearly artificial intelligence is very much to the fore, although I think I can guarantee neither Persia nor myself are indeed artificial intelligences as yet. I mean, who knows what could happen? Do you feel as though that there's a tendency to be very suspicious of any of the data that we're seeing online and indeed images that we see online? It's so easy to obviously manipulate them.
Yeah, I think so. I think people are growing increasingly kind of a little bit cautious around everything online and what we're sharing and what we're showing because of exactly what you said. Like, it's the rate of artificial intelligence is growing so rapidly, none of us really, or majority of us, don't really seem to understand what's going on. So I think that what people are really looking for, they want to feel safe, they want to feel that there's a sense of that they can trust the person, especially if you think about going on a date with someone. You know, if this person is a stranger, and you want to feel that you feel that sense of safety before you meet up with them.
Now, this summer, Badoo is actually launching the No Shades upgrade. Speak to us of that, Persia. What does that actually mean?
So this is really exciting, and it's I think it's very forward thinking on their part. So basically what it is that they're encouraging their users, because Badoo is all about fostering authentic connections. It's about being transparent and honest. They are encouraging their users to not wear sunglasses in pictures, or at least get rid of the majority of pictures where there are sunglasses, so that people can really connect with the person in the photo more. And because we have this data to show, you know, 68%, which is two-thirds, are actually off-put by people wearing sunglasses in their dating app pictures. They want their users to find meaningful connections. So it makes sense that they're, you know, they're trying to encourage them to, you know, don't wear sunglasses in all your pictures and show those beautiful eyes of yours.
Yes, I'm intrigued to see that users with multiple sunglasses pictures will receive a friendly prompt to remind them that they may be missing out on love at first sight. I wonder how friendly that prompt could actually be. I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Just a little nudge in that direction, perhaps.
Just a gentle nudge.
Yeah, which is good. Persia, you are obviously a key dating and relationship coach. You maintain that relationships are a vehicle for profound healing and growth. Did you think about this sunglasses issue yourself from your sort of past experience, or has it been a case of, yeah, if the eyes are the window to the soul, we need to actually keep them clear?
Yeah, do you know what? I hadn't really thought about it too much, like not consciously, but when this research, you know, when I was speaking to Padu and saw this research, it makes complete sense. And so, you know, the more I've thought about it and thought about my past experiences, when I felt that connection with someone, whether romantically or not, it's because you've got eye contact with them, you're looking at them in the eye, and you really feel like you're getting to know someone. And when they've got sunglasses on, there is like this sense of a bit anonymity, you're like kind of removed from them, and that connection isn't quite as intimate. So yeah, it's definitely given me a lot of food for thought thinking about it from this angle.
And presumably that achingly difficult decision that can be in terms of making your selection of which images you want to put of yourself online, variety and quality and context are all key aspects.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you want to, of course, you want to put your best foot forward, but you want to do it in a really truthful and authentic way. So don't put pictures of yourself up doing things that you don't really do. You know, there's that classic thing of the man holding the fish in his pictures. I don't know what this is about, why a lot of men seem really like inclined and drawn to show pictures of themselves holding fish. Unless you actually fish regularly, men, don't do it. And likewise, you know, if you are someone who, I don't know, rides horses often, make sure that you bring that into your profile. Bring in what is actually true and authentic to you. Don't try and get in someone else's head and assume you know best, because you always will get found out. And ultimately, you know, that is not going to put you in the best light. Another thing I really recommend is don't over filter or over edit your pictures. And don't use pictures from like 10 years ago. Use recent pictures, because what you don't want is to feel like a disappointment. If someone meets you in real life and you seem like a disappointment because you presented yourself in one way, you want to be the opposite. You want to be like, oh, you're even better in real life than you seemed on your dating profile. That's what you want to aim for.
Perhaps the fishing scenario, Persia, is a throwback to the notion of the male as the hunter-gatherer, and fishing is still seen as one of those kind of sports where maybe you can actually still engage in it with that sort of feeling, as though you're standing with your feet over a decapitated elephant or something. I'm not still just saying, you know, just a thought, really.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I thought it's got to be something to do with, you know, being manly, but I don't know. It is just quite funny, isn't it? Men holding fish.
Yeah, it's a tickling trout, perhaps, but that's another issue for another time, another case entirely. Persia, where can people go to find out more details about Badoo's No Shades upgrade?
Well, the best thing you can do is you can download the dating app Badoo and set up your dating profile. And just remember, when you do so, to really try and avoid using sunglasses pictures, or very much limit, maybe one, but no more than that.
And from your own perspective, Persia, are you actually on the socials? Can people keep updated with your awesome work in dating and relationships?
Yes. So the best place to find me is probably Instagram, just at Persia Lawson, or on my website, persialawson.com. You can find out all different ways to connect with me, and loads of amazing free resources on there to help you uplevel your dating life.
Persia Lawson, dating and relationship coach. Keep on keeping on.
Hi, this is Chase Masterson, founder of the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, the first ever organization to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBT bullying, cyberbullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture stories that we love. We all love superheroes. Why not be one? Check out our website at www.popcultureherocoalition.org. Follow us on Facebook at Pop Culture Hero Coalition and on Twitter at superhero IRL. Thanks so much.
Well, it is the great summer of exploring, apparently, in which nearly two-thirds of us aged between 25 and 34 are planning to go on a trip or a holiday or an event to a destination that they've never been to before. But what happens if they actually get into trouble whilst they're actually travelling on the roads from that point of view? Well, maybe the following item will actually give a possible solution with respect to those magical three words, specifically the location app, What Three Words. And to actually talk about the importance of this, we're delighted to welcome from the AA, that's Tony Rich. How are you, Tony?
I'm good, thanks. Good morning to you.
Okay, so Tony, I mean, I must admit, yeah, I've gone through the whole range of things when I had to call out the AA that describing where you are can be a bit of a challenge. Of course, with GPS, that becomes a lot easier. You can actually have the AA app, which locates you directly, so that helps. So, how does What's Three app or What Three Words? How does that improve that even more?
Well, what that does, what three words, it sort of it locates the person so within a 3 meter square, and so it makes it a lot easier for our patrols because it's a unique location. The patrols, they know they're going to the exact location, and it's helped our patrols out numerous times. We have about 79, 80 members a day relying on what three words to for us to find them. So yeah, it's a great bit of kit, and it's something that we use regularly.
And presumably, this is the time of the year, or I mean, any time of the year can obviously have challenges with respect to that. But is this a particularly busy time for the AA in terms of national parks, campsites, beaches, etc., being visited?
Yeah, it's one of our busiest times, sort of this time of the year, and obviously the winter with the snow, etc., ice, everything else. But yeah, we have lots of fun this time of year trying to locate people, especially if they're at festivals and places like that where they're kind of off the beaten track. They may be in a large field car park, and the location we get, and often the patrol will speak to a member and they'll just say, "Well, I'm just in a field. It's a car park." So we need more than that, and this is where What Three Words really comes into its own because, as I said earlier, on so many occasions we've used What Three Words and it takes us straight to the person. And so, yeah, festivals are a big thing for us, and we support festivals as well. So we encourage people to download the app before they go into the festival, so that not only can they find us and we can find them, but they can find the friends, they can find where the tents are, those kinds of things.
85% of the UK's police, ambulance, and fire services have acknowledged that to What Three Words can be an invaluable tool in the emergency response toolkit. I believe the AA used to be regarded as the fourth emergency service. Presumably, as you've just said, that's also going to be endorsed by What Three Words. How easy is it to download then, Tony?
It's simple. It's like downloading any other app. You can just go to Play Store or Apple, iOS, whichever. Download the app. That's it. It's working. It doesn't rely on, you can use it offline. So if you are halfway up a mountain or whatever, you can it rely on GPS to get your location for you. And it's so simple to use. I used it myself a couple of weeks ago. I picked my daughter up from the airport, massive car park at Manchester Airport, difficult to get space. So I gave my daughter when she came out, give her the What Three Words location. She next thing I was getting a tap on the boot lid of the car. So yeah, it's invaluable.
And is this just for the UK or can it also be used for European or global to traveling as well?
No, there's locations all over the world, and it's in 54 languages to date, including Welsh, and yeah, it's available everywhere.
Well, clearly, Tony, you're very much on the side of yet another app that we need to work through. And as you said, it is fairly straightforward to actually use from that point of view. Can you remind us where do we go to actually download What Three Words?
Yeah, you would just go down to Play Store or to the Apple Store, and just type in What Three Words, and there it is. You can just download it straight away.
Tony Rich from the AA, huge thanks and stay safe, Tony.
And you, thank you.
Well, it's a somewhat sobering thought that over half a century since I was certainly influenced never to even start smoking by a whole series of ad campaigns which said, smoking, it's a mug's game. Give it up. You waste so much money on cigarettes, you can use it to much better effect. Well, that still seems to be a challenge with the majority of folk within the Western world as well, as indeed research from IQOS, No Smoke Index. Is demonstrating. And to talk us through the IQOS No Smoke Index, we have indeed from the aforementioned IQOS, Harry Wake. How are you, Harry?
Hi, Ax. I'm very good. How are you?
Good. Yeah. I mean, now, no smoke index. I mean, some of the findings that we kind of would say, well, isn't it self-evident that if you are spending money on cigarettes, you might well sort of have guilt pangs. And even then, that's before we start talking about the health aspects as well. So just explain a little bit more about what this research project is all about.
Thanks, Alex. So it's IQOS. So IQOS, we call it IQOS, and the IQOS No Smoke Index is an ongoing research project we've kicked off, and it aims at going a bit deeper into the behaviours, motivations, and intended strategies of UK smokers who are considering quitting. And through this index, we're looking to shed greater light on the various factors influencing smoking habits and quitting decisions, and thereby aiding in the creation and implementation of effective harm reduction strategies. And this latest research, as you mentioned, is specifically around pricing, and it offers some great insights. For example, a quarter of smokers believe they will be forced to try and quit when the cost of a single cigarette hits the £1 mark. And we want smokers to know that cheaper and less harmful alternatives to cigarettes do exist, and that we're fully committed to doing all we can to ensure that smoke-free products replace cigarettes as soon as possible.
Okay, so IQOS itself is, for those people who are saying, is that another acronym that we'd be talking about in terms of why you were spelling it out in four letters? IQOS is a type of electronic tobacco heating system developed by Philip Morris International, which is, of course, a leading tobacco company. Inevitably, there are going to be skeptics and cynics who are saying, all right, okay, so what's in it for this company to actually put this into place from that point of view? And how do we know that this is a better alternative to indeed the weed and tobacco material that's already out there?
Yeah, so IQOS is a heating device. It heats the tobacco rather than burns the tobacco. So a cigarette burns the tobacco. Which is actually what releases the harmful cigarettes, the harmful chemicals within cigarettes. IQOS heats the tobacco, which releases substantially fewer harmful chemicals than burning the tobacco, but it maintains that tobacco flavor and that cigarette-esque experience that smokers are used to. And as a result, it's a reduced risk product. So it reduces sort of far fewer of these harmful chemicals. B, it costs much less than continuing a smoking habit. And C, it's because it's quite analogous to smoking cigarettes. It's an easy transition for cigarette smokers who don't manage to quit to make.
The likelihood is that by the end of next year, smokers will be paying £1 or more per smoke. At least that's what nearly a third of smokers predict they're going to be paying. That's a lot of money. I mean, is it any surprise that people actually want to give up the habit?
I mean, I don't think it's a surprise that people want to give up the habit. People want to give up the habit, primarily, I think, from a health perspective, and that's something we see consistently in our research. But also, of course, the financial implications. What this study did show, and in some ways it was a bit surprising, is that so many of the participants in the survey see the £1 cigarette coming. And those that see it coming, they know that quitting smoking could have a significant financial impact on their lives. And it was actually 25% of the respondents felt that the money saved from giving up the smoking habit would dramatically change their circumstances and those of their families, and 3 in 10 feel guilty today about the amount of money they spend on cigarettes.
Do you think that the zero tolerance aspect of smoking in society is ever going to be achieved, that actually we will have a time where it's just regarded as socially completely unacceptable and you just not smoke at all?
Yeah, I mean, we as a business are completely committed to a smoke-free future. In the UK, the NHS have committed to smoke-free targets by 2030. These are ambitious targets, and they're going to take a lot of work to achieve. And I think that we believe that with the right regulatory frameworks, dialogue, and support from civil society, cigarette sales can end in many countries within sort of 10 to 15 years, which obviously would be a big step forwards.
Mm. I mean, there is a suggestion that, of course, there is a huge market opening up in the developing countries, which is being exploited. I mean, again, I'll understand if you don't want to comment on that. But is that, again, something where, if you're in the tobacco industry, when one market closes, you're looking to actually open up another market?
From the perspective of our company at PMI, that's not the case at all. We are completely committed to a smoke-free future for our business. Our revenues, our ambition is for 50% of our revenues to come from smoke-free products by 2025, and we will hit that target, and we will continue advancing towards that. So no, from our perspective, we are 100% committed to a smoke-free future.
And do you use IQOS yourself, Harry?
So I'm not a nicotine user. I never have been a nicotine user. And IQOS is a product designed for existing cigarette smokers who have not quit. So I'm not an IQOS user, but I couldn't believe more in offering up to cigarette smokers who haven't managed to quit reduced risk products. And I'm a firm believer in IQOS as an excellent one of those.
I mean, it's good to hear that, like myself, you never even started. So that's all good from that point of view. But what would you say to somebody who say, you don't understand? How can you possibly understand the stresses and strains we're going through?
Look, I talk to a lot of cigarette smokers, and part of the benefits of our research is we've been able to kind of quantify and sort of pull out generalizations from speaking to so many cigarette smokers about how they feel. And you're absolutely right. There is this challenge as a cigarette smoker, because you kind of, you know, you love the habit, but you do feel guilty about doing it. We are here to help. We are here to help cigarette smokers move away from smoking cigarettes and the harm that brings. We will support cigarette smokers who seek to quit entirely. We think that is the best thing that they can do. For those that don't quit entirely, we have reduced risk products such as IQOS that can really help them move away from cigarettes to those reduced risk alternatives.
Okay, so let's move on to that classic line then. Where can people find out more about IQOS, spelled of course IQOS?
Thank you. So I think first of all, we've got the survey results. So if you're interested in that and would like to dive deeper into our research findings, those are on our website, which is www.iqos.com. But also you can find out more information about our reduced risk products on the website. And we wish any smokers seeking to move away from cigarettes the very best in their journey.
Harry Wake from IQOS, huge thanks. And stay healthy, Harry, and never start smoking.
Thanks, Alex. All the best.
When last we spoke to Norwich-based Katie Marie, we were so delighted. We felt she had to come back. She had to come back soon. It's all right that A Man in Winter is out there now. Yes, I've purchased my copy indeed, as well as coffee. The newest chilling novel by critically acclaimed author Katie Marie. But she is back with us to share more thoughts on the worlds of horror and indeed, conceivably, Letters from the Underground Street, which is a whole range of aspects that are coming through on her website. Katie Marie, welcome back to Siren Radio. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me back.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And we've just actually wrapped up a series of, some might say, horrific interviews with the likes of the What Three Words people from the AA, saying that's how we need to locate ourselves if we're going out and about. We need to have those three words in hand. And of course, IQOS, which is a way of actually giving up smoking, which apparently is also still very popular these days, even though I've never understood that myself. The reason I'm launching with that primarily, Katie, is just to really sort of say, if we're looking at horror as being reflective of our modern environment, and we touched on this on your first interview, of course, where you're looking at, we write about what we know, we write about aspects within the culture and so on. Do you feel there are certain things which kind of are forever there? Things that basically involve loss of memory, loss of function, bodily horror, all sorts of other areas? Or is it just a case of each generation kind of reinvents the wheel when it comes to horror?
Honestly, I think it's probably a combination of both of those things. I think that there's some classic tropes, for want of a better word, and they stay fresh by being reinvented. Every new generation has their own unique take on tropes that have been around since horror began, really. But then we can also bring new things to the table. And sometimes things that we think might be a lovely new thing are actually just such a big reinvention of something that came such a long time ago. Thinking in particular about like social media and whatnot. And when we see horror based around social media stories, horror stories based around social media, or I should say, they seem like, oh, this is such a unique thing. This is just for modern times because we didn't have social media back in the day. But then when you look further back, you actually find parallels with the things that came before.
I mean, interesting in terms of that, we will obviously be featuring you as our guest in an upcoming Resonance Rewind, which looks at V for Vendetta, which when Alan Moore first came up with that back in the 20th century, I think the whole notion of a collective uprising was viewed as a kind of flight of fancy. I mean, we've seen obviously areas where the Guy Fawkes masks and the other aspects, whether it be for Just Stop Oil, whether it be for climate change, whether it be for other aspects, that whole notion of moving the collective and shifting things around is very much to the fore. And I'm often I'm struck, if you even go further back, let's say to the ancient Greeks, their notion of tragedy and comedy and the masks that we all put on. Again, is that a case of we kind of go through these learning processes, and really the skill of the writer, such as yourself, is to capture some of that aspect. And then, as you said, the lead character from A Man in Winter could be seen as an R-rated version of the lead character from Up. You know, from that perspective, is that a case of, you know, this is how it works? This is what to want to basically sort of, you know, connect. It connects with people. It works on that, and that's why, you know, writers can succeed or not. Because who knows what success is? I mean, I love A Man in Winter. I think it's a fantastic book, etc. Is it going to be a multi-million dollar? I don't know. You know, who knows from that way? And neither exactly, but yeah, fingers crossed. Obviously, there is that sense.
Nice.
I mean, yeah, I'm thinking very much about the cinema industry, where I think it was Sam Golden who said the one thing he's learned about the cinema industry is that nobody knows nothing. That, in terms of that, you know, we're just flying to a certain extent on an intuitive basis.
Yes, yeah, and this is one of the things I really love about stories in general. Really, I'm not going to call myself a history buff because I'm definitely not that, but I have an interest in history, and one of my favorite parts of history, in inverted commas, is looking at the stories that we used to tell and how strange it is that all over the world, in all different times, everybody was telling the same kinds of story. But then you look at people's cultures and the same story is perceived differently in one place than another. For example, Anansi, the trickster spider from African stories, comes to mind. And he's often hailed as the hero. And Br'er Rabbit is another one that immediately pops to mind, like a revered trickster character. But if you look at, for example, I believe it's Japanese stories, they have trickster characters and they're way less revered. They still tell the same stories, but with almost like a different outcome. And it's based on how we view certain things in cultures and all that kind of bag of worms. But it's really interesting to look at how it changes.
There's a dedication that you've put in to the opening pages of A Man in Winter, which I thought was actually quite heartrending. To all of us, to all of those who, like Arthur, may one day forget us, we won't forget you.
Yes, yeah,
it's
that
a very
was,
I mean, that's a, I mean, obviously when you know the novel, when you read the whole thing, it kind of carries. But just those opening few words, very potent. I mean, it's almost as, I mean, could have been. I would have said the perfect tweet, but obviously we no longer tweet. It would be the perfect X, perhaps.
Yes, yeah, I'm still not sure how that works. The branding seems to have changed, but I think they're still called tweets at the moment. But we'll see. X.
Not if Elon has his way.
No. I'm interested to see what he's going to call them. If not tweets, they say X's. It just sounds a bit strange, but we'll see. But yeah, the dedication, the first one, because there's a couple in there. And that one that you've mentioned just there was basically my way of giving credit to all the people I spoke to who were the inspiration for Arthur. As I think I said in last time I spoke to you, I used to work in the legal profession. I was doing a lot of private client work and I spoke to people early stages of dementia to help them organize their affairs. And there were so many of them and they all had so many things in common. And that was that was my little way of sort of tipping my
Well,
hat to all
absolutely.
of them.
And whilst you're mentioning it, we'll also say the other acknowledgements. Thank you to my mum, who not only read to me when I was small and did all the voices, but who was also my first ever reader. Your encouragement and passion has kept me working. And thank you to my Paul for long conversations, thoughtful suggestions, and for making my life better in myriad ways. I mean, those were fine. I just the first one I just thought was very potent in terms of the message that was coming across, which I thought was worth sort of alluding to. Let's move on. Let's move into Letters from the Underground Street. Katie Marie, horror enthusiast and writer, of course. KatieMarieWriter.com is the website we're actually looking at from this point of view. And again, I love this, the way in which you've segmented aspects here, because you've actually broken this archive down by topic. You've got Katie's books and stories, you've got reviews, you've got real world horror. Presumably that might include things like the Ukraine and other aspects as well. Maybe not, I don't know. Writing horror, a bit of fun, of course, and of course your classic news. I mean, that whole interconnection that we have, thanks to Tim Berners-Lee and his advocacy of a free, at least point of use, World Wide Web, etc. Is that something, I mean, are you of the generation where you've known nothing else? I mean, because you're fairly young from that sort of point of view, he says, and that. Is it a case of, well, there's always been the web, or can you remember the time when actually the World Wide Web just, we didn't know it was some sort of bizarre, maybe Spider-Man exploit that we were actually seeing there. It was maybe, you know, a sort of Steve Ditko image of the web and such like.
I'm from the lovely generation, the millennial generation, where I remember a time when there was no web. I remember my very first mobile phone, and the goddamn thing was huge. It was a Nokia brick. It would probably still work today if I had it. And I remember my dad coming home one day with a computer and popping it up in our dining room and connecting to this magical internet thing. And the noise it made was horrendous because it was dial-up and it was absolutely awful. And I remember the very early days of the web, and it was so confusing, and it wasn't as visually attractive as it is now. It's far easier to navigate now, and it's a hell of a lot quicker. Like I'm sitting here in my office with my my dual monitors and my Wi-Fi, and it's so much easier to just move around in this space now. So
I mean,
yeah,
this...
I definitely remember the time before the web.
I mean, this is part of the whole thing, as indeed some of the sound effects, noises off, include the sort of obviously the police monitoring us in all sorts of ways. So they should. I suppose the next step is that notion of metaverse, because clearly this has completely revolutionized the way in which we do radio interviews. I mean, back in the 20th century, this interview would have been conducted via a phone, probably, if you weren't actually in the studio, or else we would have said, well, come up to Lincoln or come up to Teesside and do the actual thing in studio, etc. And that would involve, obviously, other sort of issues. Do you think that the metaverse, which obviously Steve, I was going to say Steve Gutenberg there, Zuckerberg, of course, Steve Gutenberg being a completely different individual, who was a good actor, but probably had nothing to do with computers in any way, shape or form, even when it was in Cocoon. But in terms of the Mark Zuckerberg thing, and I don't know where the Steve come from either, but Mark Zuckerberg and his metaverse, do you feel as though that's the next thing where effectively we will shortly be coming on board with avatars, with a whole variety of actual exports as well? And without so much as a by your leave, you simply actually become, you know, a completely different individual to actually engage with the whole process, which may or may not be a ChatGPT oriented sort of form.
I think the Steve came from Steve Jobs. That's where my
Thank
brain
you.
Went when
Thank
you started
you. Yes.
saying Steve.
Yeah,
that was like,
absolutely.
When...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But with regards to the metaverse, goodness me, whenever I hear about it, all I can think is that episode of The Simpsons. There's actually a couple of Simpsons episodes where they go into the internet and it's all like flashing lights and it looks very Tron and everyone walks around and like Facebook is like a building that you can go into. I don't know if I'd like that, to be honest. It sounds like too much walking, even if it is virtual. But I can't imagine how you'd navigate it. It would be so strange.
I think it's also fair to say that Charlie Brooker obviously has a whole thing about the way in which we can be too dependent on technology and how that technology can actually impact us as well. Clearly, when you're writing a certain form of horror, this is something else that can kind of tap into the whole concern that we actually have as human beings about, you know, Are we concerned about the web? Are we concerned about avatars? Are we concerned about creatures like John Wyndham, the midreach cuckoos, which I always used to find were quite horrifying because children can be extraordinarily terrifying.
Yes, I do like the evil children trope in horror, the idea that something so sweet and innocent can actually be scary. Have you met children? They're scary already. It's fine. But but yeah, it's always interesting to see how we fear things we don't completely understand. So things like AI, things like the internet, any kind of new technology is always ripe for use in the horror genre. And it is always really interesting to see, especially from, again, I use this word loosely, like a historical view, when we look back and we watch some of the older films where it was like, oh no, they were scared. They thought robots were gonna be running the world by now. Or they thought like aliens were gonna come over from Mars. And we've distinctly proven now that that's not quite the case.
Although I see that there have been various releases recently about UFOs that are still actually out there and occurring in all sorts of ways. Project Blue Book
yes,
is being
yeah,
revisited and so on.
Yeah,
often we
saw some clips from that one.
Yeah. When we hear talk about writing science fiction, and I think it can be coalesced with respect to horror, there is the notion that if you want to actually write science fiction, write horror, you don't have to embed yourself as a scientist. But in some ways, if you're writing crime fiction, presumably forensic fiction, etc., but it is useful to keep abreast of what is being popularized at the time. And so I'm interested in terms of, as you said, your legal background. This obviously led to the wondrousness of the winter novel, as I shall refer to it, A Man in Winter. From the sort of development of that, are there any other areas which you're sort of thinking, do you know, I might well write about that? I mean, I might well put something into practice about the whole aspect of the patriarchy and the systems and so on.
I have been flirting with the idea of writing a horror based on my legal background. Particularly, and I have been dabbling with it previously. I did a lot of medical negligence work as well, and I had to learn because of that part of my role. I had to learn an awful lot about the medical side of things. I had to learn like the names, how treatment is supposed to go, to be able to say where it went wrong, to be able to pinpoint what was actually negligence as opposed to what was just human error or a mistake, and definitely inspired, for want of a better word, me to dabble a bit in, I don't even know if this is a subgenre, but like medical horror, not quite body horror, but the idea of being in a hospital, being isolated. I did a short, it was my first attempt at an audio story, where I wrote about that there was effectively a ghost, in inverted commas, in the hospital. And nobody would believe the patients that there was something in there that wasn't a sickness, that wasn't a disease, and it was actively ending people. And it was really interesting to do that. But I don't think I could have done that without the small bit of medical knowledge that I've managed to come across.
Perhaps a good example of that in action was the late Michael Crichton, of course, who, as well as doing Jurassic Park and Westworld and such like, also gave the world Coma. I think that was based on an original line, which again was dealing with medical mispractice and malpractice and areas with respect to that. I mean, personally, I'm still actually getting to grips with the whole notion of Unikitty from the Lego movie, which traumatized me.
I love Unikitty. Favorite character. Their temper tantrums are amazing.
Exactly, exactly. Which brings us to the next question, Katie. What characters would you like to write about? Or if you had a wish list of any fictional characters or real life characters that you'd actually put together in a kind of Katie Marie universe side of things, which ones would you like to go for, basically?
Oh, see, that's really easy. I would pick up Dracula. I know he's been done to death, haha, pun intended. But yeah, I would love to write a really good Dracula story. I haven't tried it yet because I don't think I can write a really good Dracula story just yet. I hope to get there someday. But yeah, I like the idea of picking up other people's characters and sort of messing around with them, for want of a better word. I always remember Neil Gaiman saying that he, I think he won an award for what he called a piece of Sherlock Holmes fan fiction that he wrote. So I'm a big fan of stuff like that. But yeah, I definitely jump down the Dracula pathway. I might dabble in some of the other classic monsters. I do love me a bit of old cinema classic horror monsters, Dracula, Frankenstein, the Invisible Man, that kind of thing.
So the Universal era as opposed to the Hammer era, or are we going even further up the line with respect to obviously recent incarnations of the monsterverse?
I was leaning more Hammer. I do love a good bit of Hammer horror. Definitely.
So Christopher Lee rather than Bela Lugosi.
Yes. Yeah. Give me a good old bit of Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
Who doesn't love a good bit of Christopher Lee? He was a character in himself.
Very much so. Okay. Moving on to the next phase, etc. A Man in Winter. Are you at the stage now where you think, okay, I'm still happy to promote this, etc., or is it a case of once you've done the latest round of interviews and such, like you'll be saying, okay, it's time to actually put this to one side and focus on the next thing? Or, like most texts, do you sometimes feel as though, do you know, I'll dial back to that. I'll come back to some of the classics, because, you know, obviously we appreciate things at all sorts of other areas. And we talked about, obviously, the notion of Firefly, the last thing, Shadow Beneath the Surface, the notion of the water series, Sirens, no connection with the radio station, just making it quite clear. But of course, I mean, that one won the Douglas Barber Award for Speculative Fiction from that point of view. Are we going to see a return to those, or is it a case of, no, you like to keep the various aspects completely separate?
I think it's probably that I would keep them separate. I'm perfectly happy to go through and promote some of my older pieces. Man of Winter definitely isn't that, not yet. But I do think it is always important to keep moving forward. Like, while I'm here today talking to you about various things, Man of Winter being one of them, I also have another novel that is out to agent, and it's out with some publishers at the moment. I'm working on another piece, working title being The House, which is my attempt at a traditional haunted house story, but sort of turned on its head. So I do like to keep moving forward. And I think maybe when, say, for example, the one that's out to agent at the moment, working title, A Walk in the Woods, if that got picked up and got published and was then being promoted, I think I would probably dial back the Man in Winter promotion. Although I would always be happy to talk about Arthur. He's my baby boy.
Absolutely. Collaborations with other authors. We kind of touched on this, I think, last time around, but I'm conscious that Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, of course, the late Terry Pratchett, their second series of Good Omens has just emerged, and obviously the whole notion of Good Omens working through. Ever tempted to actually go down a line of horror as comedy and develop those sort of things there? Because let's face it, there are a number of horror spoofs that have emerged over the years, which have become classics in their own way, not just Little Shop of Horrors, of course.
I am actually working on a horror comedy comic at the moment. I can't draw for a dime, but I like to think I can write. So I'm currently working on a horror comic, which is supposed to be funny. Canva is amazing for people who can't draw. It helps you put things together. But I would also not be adverse to collaboration. I did actually work with a friend of mine a while ago on a project that never managed to get its legs under it. And we were working on a comic together because, unlike me, she can draw.
And let's talk advice, because, I mean, clearly we haven't got Jessica Burtis with us this time around. She's still tucked happily away doing her dissertation, final thesis in North Carolina. But what advice would you actually have for the budding writer? Or is it, again, as Isaac Asimov once said, you want to be a writer, write?
I think that's actually a really important part of it. You're not going to be a writer if you don't sit down and actually pick up a pen or start typing with a keyboard. So yes, to be a writer, you definitely need to write, shockingly enough. But my personal bit of advice, and I'm sorry, I'm not particularly original here, it's to read voraciously, read widely. Don't just I don't just read horror books. They're definitely my favorite, but I do try to read a bit more widely. I would also try and develop your skills for compassion and empathy, because you will write people different from yourselves. Otherwise, your books are going to be boring because they're all going to be about the same person. So you will write people different to yourselves. And the best way to do that and do that well is with compassion and empathy for other people's experience.
I think when last we spoke, we were just going into the New York Book Festival. Again, the book festival season is going quite well in terms of a whole variety of other bits and pieces. Where can we next see Katie Marie in person?
Oh, goodness. I don't actually have anything booked. So I'm hiding
outrageous.
Myself away. I know. I'm proper hidden. You have to come and scour north and try and find me.
Well, I'm sure it'll happen in the fullness of time that we'll work our way through that, because
tend to go to things like Comic Cons and whatnot, but I'm a purchaser. I'm not a oh goodness, what's the name?
Presenter, a host as yet.
There you go.
Exactly. If George Mann can have a successful San Diego Comic Con, it's only a matter of time before they're inviting Katie Marie over as well. It will happen. it's very critical.
That would be amazing.
And in terms of the overall side of things, then, a good year so far? I mean, we're kind of obviously into the second part of 2023. Are you quite satisfied? Or is there a kind of a grand master plan that you put in place which says, well, I need to have that Hugo Award coming up, at least, you know, for the next one?
God, time is a lie. I can't believe it's August next week. It's proper messing with me. It's going to be Christmas before we know where we are. Well, I was going to say the next time I talk to you, it'll be Christmas, but it won't. It'll be Friday. But yeah, time moves so quickly. But yes, this year's actually been good. I've been very, very productive this year. I've definitely been expanding things like Tales from the Underground Street, which is my website. I've been doing a lot of podcasts and guest articles, which is always marvelous. And I have been working on a few different projects. I'm not as satisfied with this year as I'd like to be. I always think I could do better than I definitely have done. And that's probably one of my biggest character flaws, is that I put far too much pressure on myself. If I ever succeed at something, I always think, oh yeah, that's great, but I could have done it better. So it's not my most endearing character trait, unfortunately. But yeah, I do still wish that I had sold more short stories this year. That would have been nice.
Well, things will work out in their own way. Best place to reach you, presumably, still katiemariewriter.com.
That's me.
Excellent. And, well, we'll go through the last two questions because they are essential in terms of the whole thing before we actually head into a little feature, which is all about resummation, which is actually a new form of cremation using water.
Oh, water cremations. Again, I saw this on YouTube. The Ask a Mortician lady talked about it.
Well, there we are, you see. Following on with respect to that, we have a whole new feature on that. Following, I just thought it fits quite well after featuring yourself with your horror routine to go into a resummation from that point of view. So have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this, your return to the author feature on the Midweek Drive?
I've had a lovely time, thank you.
And the next critical question, we've already answered it to a certain extent, because you're coming to join us for a Resonance Rewind in the very near future, when we'll be looking at V for Vendetta.
Fantastic film. Love it. Love the book.
Now, clearly the old line about there being only two certainties in life, i.e. death and taxes, is still very much present in the 21st century. But when we actually do go, what's the preferred way of actually going? Clearly, some people prefer to be buried 6 feet under. Some people prefer to simply say, OK, we'll be cremated. But what about water cremation or resummation? Arguably the biggest change to funerals in more than 120 years is actually coming about now. Well, we're delighted to feature two fine folk who'll be able to talk about this particular aspect, which was indeed chosen by Archbishop Desmond Tutu for his funeral arrangements back in 2021. The two souls that we're delighted to speak to today are Director of Resummation Service at Kindly Earth. That's Julian Atkinson. How are you, Julian?
Hello, Matt. Yeah, very well, thank you.
And from the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University, we've got Professor Douglas Davis. How are you, Douglas?
I'm very well, thanks, and good to be here.
Well, likewise. Now, Douglas, this particular process, I can already hear people saying, oh, I don't know about that. What is it all about? How can it be cremated with water? Surely the water will put out the flames, etc. What were your initial thoughts when the whole process effectively emerged? And obviously with Desmond Tutu, obviously electing to have his funeral service conducted in this manner.
My thoughts were with how inventive the British are when it comes to death. Because late in the 19th century, cremation came on the cards, though it took, nearly 50 years before even 1% of the British public got round to being cremated. But then things really speeded up as the 20th century went on, so that by the time we got to the 1960s, more than half of the British public was being cremated. So it was that issue of invention and of how people move ahead and sometimes wait for the law to catch up with current practice. Then I was very interested in the 1990s and did considerable amount of research on what was then called green woodland or eco burial. And that again was quite a change. And now we have hundreds of green burial sites across the country. So when I heard some years ago now of a resumation or whatever particular name we want to give to alkaline hydrolysis, it seemed to me, yes, here are the British rethinking the whole issue of death in relation to their environment. And with the background fact that the British are great engineers, because without the engineering of the Industrial Revolution, we wouldn't have had cremation. And in a sense, without precision engineering going into the equipment lying behind resumation, we wouldn't have that other either. So I saw those things as running together. And I don't think actually that the funeral trade, in terms of the minds of people, is necessarily conservative. I think the Brits are often quite used to thinking, yes, I'll fit it in with how I live. And maybe the ecological, environmental attitude with its values is part of how the British think and feel.
Julian, the notion of us being food for worms, as put forward in Dead Poets Society a good few years ago, is something which is at the heart of, obviously, the cyclical nature of life and so on. Now, first, I see that some evidence suggests that this resummation process could be more sustainable than gas cremation, with almost a third of UK adults actually choosing alternative committal methods if available. So presumably, from your own point of view, this is something you'd very much like to sing the praises of.
Yeah, I've always had a keen eye on the environment. And when I came across this technology, I looked at it very carefully to see how it compared to other forms of disposition. And that was obviously cremation, because there simply isn't any other anything else which is on the market at the moment. You know, this is offered in America, and in Canada and in South Africa. So we had good data to work with. And looking at that data using life cycle assessments, we were able to study what's available here, as in the cremation, and compare it with what resumation was showing us. And it showed there was and could be a significant upside to resumation, not just because it uses water and it's a more gentle process, but because it uses less fossil fuel in the process. And the fossil fuel, as we know, is climate changing, and I think that we all have to change our ways to meet the carbon objectives and to reduce climate warming. So yes, from that point of view, it definitely appealed, and it's felt something I wanted to get involved in bringing it to the UK and making it available for families to choose from when they come to arrange a funeral.
So breaking it down into its practicalities, the deceased is enclosed in a biodegradable pouch, placed in a container filled with pressurized water, a small amount of potassium hydroxide, that's KOH if you're a chemist. Each cycle obviously takes approximately 4 hours. At the end of that cycle, the soft bones which are left are dried, then reduced to a white powder, which is similar to ash, and the remains then returns to relatives in a sustainable urn. So presumably there's still the opportunity for people, should they wish, to obviously take the deceased ashes and scatter them on the favourite football ground or location they prefer to actually have their ashes scattered.
Yes, it's fair to say the funeral people can choose what they want. They can have any type of funeral they want. That might be contemporary, might be traditional. They go to a church, may go to some another point of gathering, say their goodbyes. The resignation takes place with the deceased in our care. We return the ashes in a sustainable urn to the family. And then the family, there's different customs. You know, some people like a favorite walk, a favorite place, favorite holiday destination, in the garden, planting trees. You know, there's a lot of variations we hear about. And some people go for more exotic, like want to be dropped from the sky from a plane and things like this. But in the main, people like to keep the ashes at home, scatter the ashes or bury the ashes, usually in a family burial plot.
Douglas, is this a preferred choice for yourself, or are you more of a traditionalist?
Well, at the moment, I'm a scholar, because my great task in life has been to study early on the reuse of old graves, cremation, woodland burial, and now this. So my ideas tend to change as my knowledge shifts. So what I think today might be quite different tomorrow. So I prefer to keep my thoughts to myself.
I was going to say, you're clearly keeping your options open there, Douglas. Don't worry, we won't press you. Julian, same question for yourself. Have you said, yes, this is definitely the way I'll be going?
Well, I have thought about a funeral wishes, which is hardly surprising. And, you know, given all the upside and being honest with Desmond Tutu leading the way, I really feel I have no problem in saying tick the box for resignation for me.
There you go. And where can people find out further details about resignation and indeed your package with respect to Kindly Earth?
For me, Kindly Earth, it's a simple website address, Kindly Earth. And for finding out about funerals and how resignation can be offered, I suggest going onto the co-op website and just type in resignation on the search bar, and you should get some helpful advice from there on.
Julian Atkinson, Director of Resignation Service for Kindly Earth, and Professor Douglas Davis from the Department of Theology and Religion at Durham University. Many thanks indeed, and let's hope that it's many, many years before you actually need to think seriously about those particular areas. Who knows, by that time you might be downloading your consciousness into an artificial form, an intelligence that actually works as an android that grants a form of immortality, which could be another theological question, I'm sure, Douglas.
I'm sure it could.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, Alex.